seems like a China airline. Yeah, China.
I don't have any fans on me.
That's a lot.
Yeah, should. Is it on?
Yeah.
Hello, testing. Can you hear me? Okay. All right. Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you very, very much for your attendance, and particular credos to Dr. Frank Frost for, I'm not going to be oxymoronic by saying organizing this bedlam, but nevertheless, we're very, very honored that you would give us some of your time today to interact with our very distinguished overseas guests. I think to begin with, perhaps Roxanne, you might wish to just give the opening remarks and we'll go from there. Thank you.
Yes, well, I'd like to welcome everybody to this seminar, and in particular to thank Frank for organising it, and to thank our very, very distinguished set of panel members today. We're very privileged to be able to have you here. Interest in Asia-Pacific regional cooperation is very high in the Australian Parliament. It's an area of great complexity of issues, and we feel enormously privileged that we have so many people with so many great insights who are able to be here today. So I'd like you to welcome you all to the Parliamentary Library and to say we all look forward very much to benefiting from the great knowledge that you have, and thank you so much for coming.
Thank you. We'll kick this off with two very brief opening statements. Frank Frost will represent the parliamentary side of the House, I suppose, in regard to just setting a bit of context, conceptual context, for some of the issues that we hope to cover. Then I've asked Professor Sheldon Simon to reciprocate with perhaps just 2 or 3 minutes worth of dot point type opening remarks, and then we'll get right into it in terms of dialogue and interaction. Perhaps before those start, we might just briefly go around the table and have our participants introduce themselves to you so that we all know who's talking to you too. So Henning, I think if you could just start.
Once again, thank you very much.
Yeah.
Thank you for the invitation. I'm Professor Henning Kopp from the University of Copenhagen, Denmark. I'm a professor of constitutional law, and my expertise is in European constitutional law and emergency legislation, including counterterrorism and so on. I'm a member of the government's committee on the drafting of legislation, our first legislation on the civil on the intelligence services.
Thank you.
And my name is H. Katahara, and I'm a researcher at the National Institute for Defense Studies of the Ministry of Defense, Japan. And I specialize in U.S. strategic policy, and U.S. evaluations, and U.S. and Japan's evaluations, and Japan's East Asian strategic issues in general. And I'm happy to be back here because I did my master's at ANU and PhD at Griffith University, so I regard Canberra as my second home. Thank you.
My name is Roy Camphausen. I lead the Politics and Security Affairs Group and direct the Washington, D.C. office of the National Bureau of Asian Research, which is an American think tank research institute. And prior to joining NBR, I was in our Department of Defense as a China specialist, a couple tours at the embassy in Beijing, and policy tours in the Pentagon after that.
Thank you. Nice to be back with friends, Frank, Andrew, Michael. I'm also an ANU apparatchik. I'm from Singapore and work on national security issues. Thank you.
I'm Philip Toll from Cambridge. I also have an ANU connection. I was here as a visiting fellow from 78 to 80, and I teach international security.
Shogo Suzuki from the University of Manchester, and my expertise is mainly in Chinese foreign policy and Sino-Japanese relations, and I'm also a product of the ANU PhD program, so it's a joy to be
here. I have to make clear that ANU is not giving any of these guys retainers.
This is awkward. I'm Keiji Fujiwara. I teach at the University of Tokyo. I teach international relations. And unfortunately, I do not have an ANU connection. Although it so happens that I come to this country every year for various purposes. Thank you.
Well, my name is Akihiko Tanaka. I'm also a professor at the University of Tokyo, specializing in international politics. It is my pleasure to be able to come here to share with you about important issues listed here. Thank you.
And I'm Sheldon Simon. I'm a professor of international politics at Arizona State University and an old friend of Bill's. We go back many, many years. And I also am a friend of Frank's, also going back a number of years. I work in the area of the international politics of the Asia Pacific.
Well, I'm Sakato from Japan Foundation. I am the only person who is not an expert of strategic affairs or international politics. So please don't ask questions. Since our foundation supports various conferences or research projects in which topics of common interest are dealt with. And I'm trying to know something of everything. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I'm Chu Feng from Beijing University. I'm a professor of a School of International Studies there. My specialty is East Asian security. Thank you.
My name is Ken Jinbo. I'm from Keio University. My specialty is on the regional security in Asia. And also, I don't have a special attachment to the ANU as well, but I actually spent 1 year in Australia when I was 16 years old, a town called Ipswich in Queensland, and a famous constituency of Honourable Paulin Hanson.
My name is Lowell Dittmer. I'm a professor of political science at the University of California at Berkeley and editor of Asian Survey. My specialty is really Chinese foreign policy. It's a pleasure to be here, the first time I've been in Australia.
I'm Ole Weber, a professor of international relations at the University of Copenhagen. My main areas are theories of security, including theories of regional security.
Great. Okay, Frank, perhaps you'd like to lead off and then show.
Well, look, I get up with suitable humility in this position and with a distinguished group of visitors. Let me just make a couple of... Sorry about that. Let me just make a couple of very brief comments about some of the things that I think from our perspective we and the audience are interested in. There isn't a parliamentary perspective on East Asia and Asia Pacific cooperation because the parliament quite properly is representing the main political forces in Australia through its members, its staff of members, representatives of parliamentary committees, of which there are two who are here today, and then our role in the Parliamentary Library and Research Service as researchers on many issues, including these issues. Not easy to compress to a couple of minutes what we might be interested in, but let me just say a couple of things. From an Australian point of view, there has always been a lot of interest in East Asia and Asia Pacific cooperation. It's been a consistent interest in Australian foreign policy probably from the 30s and 1940s at least. Australia was one of the first countries to set up a multilateral relationship with ASEAN in 1974. We were a founder member of APEC, as everyone knows. We were very pleased to be admitted and a part of the first meeting of the East Asia Summit at the end of 2005. Our interest in these issues has been highlighted by our experience in joining and participating in the East Asia Summit after we had acceded to ASEAN's Treaty of Amity and Cooperation, the holding in September last year of the APEC meetings in Sydney, a very big presence and issue in Australia. I can think of lots of issues, and I'll just confine myself to a couple to mention them now. I think there's a lot of interest in Australia about the character and the adequacy of the existing forums and groups and institutions, current and emerging institutions in the region. There are questions which are being discussed in Australia about whether new institutions are needed. For example, the question of whether a Northeast Asia Security Forum may evolve from the six-party talks. There are questions about what is likely to be the medium-term likely future and role for our newest part of the architecture, the East Asia Summit. a contribution which I'm sure you're familiar with has been made an interesting way to this debate in Australia by Alan Gingell from the Lowy Institute, who suggested that in looking at Asia-Pacific and East Asian architecture, it's interesting and useful to look at what we, the community and the countries and the peoples, what we need rather than what we have necessarily. He made several interesting suggestions, whether there's a need for a different kind of security dialogue, whether there is a case for the leaders' meeting of APEC to be drawn apart from APEC and set up as a separate institution. It'd be interesting just to discuss some of these issues. Another major issue, which everybody will realise, is the evolving attitudes of the major powers to East Asian cooperation. Which I won't try and summarise, let's talk about that in a moment. One interesting one, of course, is the role of the United States and whether, for example, when there is a new administration in office in Washington after November the 4th or after January the 20th, there will be an interest in reaffirming and revising and maybe changing the emphasis somewhat in the United States approaches to East Asian cooperation. There are some issues and ideas in the works under discussion by American analysts. For example, whether the United States might be interested in acceding to the Treaty of Amity and Cooperation, as other countries, including Australia, have done, and whether that might, for example, open up an avenue for the United States to become an observer with the East Asia Summit, if that was of interest and acceptable to the summit members. It's interesting, speculative, but we're certainly thinking about this here very much, about the evolving American political contest and what the attitudes and approaches of the leading, what are now the leading three candidates might be towards regional cooperation. And finally, and naturally from an Australian point of view, we're interested and we're always interested in what are the options and avenues for Australia in relating to the region. How can we, from Australian side, consolidate our involvement in and advance our involvement in APEC, the ASEAN Regional Forum and the East Asian Summit? And what additional ideas, strategies, avenues would contribute from an Australian point of view to the evolving architecture and the evolving avenues of cooperation in the region? So, that's all pretty easy. I think we can get through that. Very sure. So thanks very much, and I'll hand it back to the chair.
Thanks, Frank.
Some of the issues which interest us.
We'll have Cheryl perhaps just give about a 2 or 3 minute rejoinder, whatever strikes his fancy, and then I'll open it up and invite members of the audience to either ask questions or make comments. And of course, when I do that, you'll identify who you are and what part of the parliamentary aspects you're affiliated with. But Shell first, just a couple.
Thanks, Bill. This is by no means a rejoinder. I think we could spend about a week with Frank's very important topics. What I'd like to do is just mention two or three of some of the findings for the paper that I prepared for this conference, titled U.S., Japan, and Australia, Security Linkages to Southeast Asia. First and foremost, it seems to me, if you look at the strategies of Washington, Tokyo, and Canberra, you discover, not surprisingly, that they're very different. The U.S., particularly post 9/11, as a global power, is primarily focused on the Middle East. Asia is definitely in second place. Not third place, but second place. Australia, of course, is a major regional power, and its primary strategic concerns are in this neighborhood. Japan, a global economic power, but also essentially a regional security power with a Northeast Asia focus. So you have three very different grand strategies, if you will, coming from these three capitals. The good thing is that they're not incompatible strategies. And indeed, they can converge, they do converge, I think, in the following areas. Freedom of the slots for international trade, counterterrorism, and the promotion of political stability within the Asia-Pacific. Now, having said that, when one looks at the ASEAN states, which is what my study has done, What you see is that the ASEAN states essentially follow a hedging strategy toward external great powers. They want their economic and their security participation, but they don't want any of them to dominate their security, their own security preferences. Moreover, and this is something I think we'll certainly talk about later on, at least in terms of what I found, Southeast Asian states are somewhat suspicious of trilateral security cooperation. They see it as being developed perhaps as an alternative to the ARF, and they're worried about that. And finally, I'll simply conclude with this, with a nod to Ole Weaver. With the exception of Singapore, ASEAN states oppose securitizing anti-piracy and anti-terrorism activities in the South China Sea and the Malacca Strait. ASEAN members prefer to deal with the challenges as maritime crime, not as national defense issues. And as maritime crime, they are defined as law enforcement problems rather than strategic problems, and therefore a function of national jurisdictions rather than international strategic cooperation. And I'll close with that.
Okay, great. Well, it's a very fine, I think, set of deliberations to kick off our proceedings here. I now would like to invite questions from the floor. We'll get started. We have a little over an hour. I promised that this was a sort of sing for your supper type syndrome. What I didn't tell the participants is that the supper is only sandwiches, but that's okay. We'll go from there. And we are very grateful to Frank and parliamentary colleagues for providing us with a bit of sustenance at the end of the day so we can move on. So shall we open with questions comments? Don't be shy. What was that, a Beatles song? Don't be shy. Okay, that was a prompt. We'll start over here and then move right across. Yeah, go ahead.
I'm currently doing a Master's of International Relations at New South Wales University.
I'm sorry, and just your name.
My name is Kerry Huxley. Thanks, I work Kerry. For New South Wales Senator. Mm-hmm. I'm interested in what Professor Simon said regarding the distinction between maritime and sovereign definitions of crime regarding piracy versus the other. Could you expand on the differences and their ramifications?
One of the concerns that you find among at least two of the three littoral states along the Malacca Straits, that is Indonesia and Malaysia, this is not true of Singapore. Indonesia and Malaysia are very concerned about large external powers taking over control of security in the Straits. They view this as impositions on their sovereignty. So one of the ways in which they attempt to redefine the situation is that, first of all, there hasn't been any maritime terrorism. There has been, of course, maritime piracy. And piracy is a criminal issue. It's handled through criminal laws. And therefore, cooperation should occur through law enforcement agencies, which, of course, include coast guards rather than navies. Japan has been very, very helpful, for example, in helping Indonesia develop its coast guard, similarly in Malaysia. So that's the distinction I'm making here.
And are they effective?
Yeah, I think they have been, or they are becoming effective. This is still a program in transition. Piracy is down in the Strait. Whether you can attribute that to the activities of the coast guards, I'm not so sure, but piracy is definitely down.
Can I add a small section to it? I think piracy is also partly down to what Simon said, but it's also as a result of rejecting the RMSI and all the programs from outside, is that it has compelled the literacy to cooperate together. Out of that has come the joint patrols. But as far as the strategic, bigger strategic dimension, the unstated aspect, I mean, openly, you're right, we want the Americans and outsiders to run. Or set the agenda for a strategic dimension. But it's an unstated fear that we do not want to get caught in this, I mean, for lack of a better word, that this is part and parcel of a China containment exercise. Mm-hmm. The fear that if the Americans and all the others get into the picture, start patrolling the Straits of Malacca, have bases here and there, that you're going to upset the Chinese, amongst others. Mm-hmm. So what I think Shell says is correct, but I think there's part two to it. And that partly explains why there is actually allergy to things when there are proposals of this nature. So second, I think there's something else too. But at the same time, the downsizing of the piracy and all that is also because of the effective, I think, countermeasures, not just because of the liberal state's effort. I think the Australians, the Americans, all have also chipped in, the Japanese, and that have actually assisted in capacity building and hence the effectiveness in overtaking the problem.
And Bill, there or Shell, either one, from the Australian perspective, of course, we recently implemented a maritime exclusion zone. And I'm just wondering if either of you are aware of whether this spills over into the concerns about either the sovereignty issue on one hand or perhaps a containment issue on the other.
Yeah, I'd be interested in hearing what Bill Lyric has to say, but I think Indonesia is concerned about that. Yeah.
I think another concern perhaps is there's some fear that if the United States gets extensively involved, it will bring terrorism to the area.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's a good point.
As in Iraq, I mean, that Iraq has become a seedbed for the recruitment of terrorists. And
that makes sense.
Although the U.S. really is involved in the region with respect to counterterrorism, you've got U.S. Special Forces operating in Mindanao, they've been there for years. You have the FBI and the Australian Federal Police working very closely with the Indonesian National Police, very effectively, on helping to suppress JI, for example. Mm-hmm. So the outside powers are there in counterterrorism, but they do try to maintain a low profile.
Yeah. Okay. Bilger, did you have another comment?
No, I think the concern in Indonesia is that I think the others have been relatively quiet. But this issue has not really picked up in public about the exclusion zone. Primarily the focus was RMSI, and then it died down somewhat because of it's a non-starter. And but as far I think the next phase of concern will be the EZ. I think you're right.
Great, thanks. And the next question I think was a gentleman in a nice looking tie. Yeah. Or doesn't matter.
Can I just react to what was said just now? Because it seemed to me that one of the issues, Michael Ong from the Oriental Library. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that one of the issues regarding sort of terrorism, which has been mentioned, and securitization, is that it is interesting that the approach to terrorism, per se, between the Americans, particularly, and, say, the Europeans, or even, I suspect, the other countries, is that they see it as a criminal offense rather than a security, strategic, grand strategic approach. And therefore, you know, sort of the aims and targets are very different, and the short and long-term objectives are also very different. You know? And in that sense, when you look at, you've mentioned the trilateral countries now, and the region, if you are in the region looking out, mm-hmm. you say, excuse me, what are these three guys trying to do here? Mm-hmm. What are they getting out of it? You know? Who's running the show? I mean, these are basic questions that the countries in the region would be asking. And yeah, that's my comment. My question is much more broader, is that given that Australia has recently got a new government under Rudd, what is the expectation, given the expertise from Europe and now Japan, China, and so on here, what is the expectation from your country's perspective towards Australia? I mean, we have, for example, in this morning paper, reaction from the Japanese, we're concerned that Mr. Rudd has not mentioned Japan, you know, in his speech, you know. We have a concern from the opposition here, say that, you know, he's too pro-China, you know. And we have also concern expressed that, okay, you know, he's pulling out of the alliance, those Americans say that he's still a good guy and he's still a man of steel, la 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 la. But what you have is different reaction and reaction. I'm just wondering whether, from your country's perspective, what are your expectations of Australia under a Rudd government?
Shall
I? Well, I would think that would be directed to the whole panel.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
It would be interesting to see the Europeans reacting instead of the Japanese and Chinese or even Singapore. Yeah.
Maybe we can start with the Americans and then we can go out to others. Maybe Roy, you might give that a shot if you're so inclined to. What does the U.S. expect from Australia in terms of the new Rudd government? You're in Washington. Have you picked up a read on that?
It's, I guess, two very short points. The first is on some of the big issues, tough issues, perhaps. The positions are already outlined and on the part of the Australian government vis-a-vis Iraq to take immediate put into place the policies that would execute the campaign promises. And so in some respects, then, that issue is not going to linger. It's it's been dealt with. So the second thing then is then it's a traditional, I think, American expectation that Australia will be a strong partner and one that, you could use the phrase, speaks truth to power, is very frank in its dealings with leaders in the United States from a position of trust. And in that respect, I don't think there's any big difference from the way it's been. On the particular issue of China, it'll be interesting to hear Professor Ditton's thoughts. I'm personally curious, given my own work and interest in China, the degree to which the particular interaction between the Prime Minister and President Bush either reinforces each other or introduces nuances that haven't been there before from the American perspective. You could argue that that President Bush has as pro-engagement a policy towards China as almost any American president, and that is in stark contrast to his position when he was campaigning in 2000 and certainly the early months of his administration in 2001 prior to 9/11. So there's probably a lot of convergence between their two views, although outsiders might think that the Prime Minister might have a lot of nuance to offer to President Bush. And in the statement from their joint news conference the other day, in a perhaps not as articulate way as you might have hoped, President Bush basically said, I agree with what he said, after the Prime Minister talked about Tibet and other issues. So I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
Well, as we all know that Australia has the only Prime Minister in the world who speaks fluent Chinese, experience, diplomatic experience. And I think that in contrast to his predecessor, he wants very much to bring China in. So the idea of a League of Democracies that's been proposed by one of our candidates recently is something he would resist, I think. He would try to avoid defining Australia's position as anti-China or pro-US in a sort of bipolar way, being more inclusive and bringing both China and the United States together.
Delve into this just a bit deeper. You're talking about McCain, of course, in terms of the proposal for the axis of democracies. I find axis to be a bit unfortunate term. but I'm wondering what happens when, through whatever channels, Mr. Rudd says no, politely. Are people like Armitage or whoever else are advising? Because Armitage has a bit of a reputation down here. Which is essentially, if you don't come together with us in Taiwan, the alliance is toast. So what happens then? Do the Americans become flexible, or are we going to see a potential for possible alliance tension coming into play here? I'm just being deliberately provocative, but what do you think?
You have to hope for a Democratic victory.
any takers on that one? The question really has to do with who are the people around McCain, if in fact he gets in. No response. Roy, you're the Washington.
I know the people around him, and I just don't think they've. It is an early campaign talking point. Mm. I don't know how much legs it's going to have, frankly.
Okay, that's a good. Yeah, I think you had your hand up, sir.
Mm-hmm. Jeffrey Robson from the Parliamentary Library. My question is on the evolution of the six-party talks. And I was reading an ANU paper this morning, and it was saying how once the six-party talks, and if and when the nuclear issue is resolved, then there could be a multilateral security institution. And they were basically saying that it should maintain the same minimum membership without any other parties joining into that multilateral institution. And for Australians, actually the paper described Australians as the anxious analysts from Australia. And I was a little bit concerned about that. I was a little bit anxious. What do you think about Australian participation in any future multilateral security institution?
Perhaps we can give some of our Northeast Asian analysts an opportunity to come into play here. So, for example, the Shogo and Geechee and Akio, you might want to just pontificate.
Well, to be perfectly honest, I really don't know what role Australia can play, because they're not the parties who are directly involved in this one. China, for instance, has to worry about North Korea doing anything silly and causing security, to be destabilized by North Korea. Japan certainly does not want to have the threat of North Korean nuclear missiles. Australia doesn't immediately face that kind of threat. If any role Australia can play, it would be probably in maybe patrolling the proliferation of nuclear materials by North Korea, and maybe playing a maritime role. I think that would be the main role which would be that Australia can play. But on the other hand, Australia doesn't have a huge stake in North Korean politics either. China is the influencer it's supposed to be the patron, although its influence has diminished alarmingly within North Korea. Japan certainly can hurt North Korea to a certain extent through economic sanctions as well. And South Korea can engage directly. But on the other hand, Australia doesn't have that immediate stake within North Korean politics. So my view is participation might be, or Australia's participation would not have much effect. That's my own sense of things.
That actually reflects what I was thinking on the paper, because, I think the way you were talking about it, it's on the six-party talks as they are now. But the paper was trying to argue that it's after the nuclear issue is resolved and it's a new security institution. But they kind of got confused between, whether it should still be the same six members or whether other members can join in. And I think because the six-party talks are so focused on the nuclear issue, kind of muddies the concept of a post-nuclear issue security institution. And that's the part that I'm interested in, whether Australia should actually play a role in that post-nuclear issue six-party process.
We have your set of time for the
six-party talks.
Thank you, Professor. I think if six-party talk could successfully just resolve the nuclear issue of North Korea, I mean, just dismantling the North of their nuclear capability. Evolution of the multilateral security arrangement in your region is just one of the options. It might be, but I don't think it should be. So then, if such an option, I mean, just the evolution of the multilateral security arrangement could be achieved, I think it should be just open to all regional members. So Australia, of course, should be involved inevitably then, because I think such a security arrangement also should just articulate a variety of security matters or subjects. Then just as Professor Simon say, Australia is also a major power in the region. China also will just pay more attention to Australia's futures parts you can just take in the regional security building. So then I think if such a multilateral framework just expressed, Australia should be there and it's also a formidable member.
No, I think, the precondition, if and when the nuclear issue is resolved, well, that's a big if. And in my perspective, it may take many more years when that issue is behind us. I think there is some connection between what we would expect the ARF to play in the future role when it comes to the future multilateral security framework in East Asia. If this big conditional is resolved, then things can become very open And then, but the, if you know, this six-party talks can be enlarged to, you know, open to everyone, then what's the difference between that to ARF and others? And so we need to think about many more things.
Allow me to jump in. I echo my colleague's comment on this. The end of the six-party talk is not in sight, to put it mildly. There are various reasons for this, but if I may say so, the interests of the powers are quite diverse. Many members are quite happy to live with a nuclear North Korea. I shouldn't be saying this, but I would say that Russia and South Korea are not strongly against a nuclear North Korea. And I doubt if China would agree to strong measures disarming a nuclear North Korea, although I think that China is not happy with a nuclear North Korea. Japan is the strongest opponent against North Korea, and in fact, precisely because of this, Japan has a chance of being isolated in the talk. So starting from this six-party talk was not a very good way to start a security architecture in the region. It was a necessary step. We had to do it. We had a real threat there. But then if we model a security architecture from this particular case, we'll never get there. Therefore, we may have to redraw the line and think of alternate or new additional element into the picture, such as arms control. I personally believe that without a commitment toward future arms reduction in China and the United States, there will never be an NPT regime in Northeast Asia. And for that matter, Australian participation is critical because, after all, you are heavily involved in the nuclear energy cycle. The other thing is ASEAN. ASEAN is not a strong organization. But having said that, this is virtually the only regional institution we have in North or Southeast Asia. And that is precisely the reason all institutions in the region somehow started with ASEAN, ASEAN Plus 3, APEC, ARF, all of these have ASEAN at the core. There are some shortcomings of this. Because ASEAN is in the driving seat, the element of institutionalization in all of these institutions has been limited. But having said that, this means that if we want to expand Northeast Asian security dialogue into any institution-like measures, we simply cannot kick out ASEAN from the picture. And this also means that Tokyo would be eager to invite Australia into the orbit, because nowadays Tokyo seems to believe that ASEAN has fallen into Beijing's orbit. This is related to the first question, on how does Tokyo react to the new administration in Australia? Tokyo, the government in Japan, is afraid of any new government in the region, believing that the new government would put more emphasis on their relationship to China and not Japan. There is almost a fatalistic feeling in Tokyo that everybody really loves China and not Japan. But having said that, this is not really something that should dictate our policy, because a government that can engage China into significant talk is something of a plus to us. And in fact, this is precisely what the Fukuda administration is doing right now in Tokyo. So instead of whining about bypassing Japan, I guess we should think about working on a concerted effort to bring China into our institution. Thanks.
That's great. You're right. Okay.
I'll just offer a two-finger on that. I agree with the perspective that we should assess whether the six-party process works before we talk about broadening it and applying it to other cases. And I think that's the dominant position. I guess the risk is that we would throw the success of the process itself, whether the outcome is successful. The process has brought together really diverse positions, and they've been managed in a, you have to say, fairly successful way. There are national positions that are not easily in convergence, and the parties have worked, if if not always smoothly, there's been some collective learning that has occurred. And so, but I don't know how you translate that then, right? And that's, I guess, the key challenge. But the shame of it would be that that collective learning among the participants is discarded and a fresh start is begun and the relearning or the learning has to occur again.
No, I agree to that. And that's one of the reasons why the six party should not end or dissolve. We need that. Yes, I agree.
I think you were next. Yeah. And tell us who you are.
So I'm a Kuwait Foreign Affairs Group Parliamentary Library. My question, I guess, is to all participants, and it is a reflection on Australia's role in regional cooperation and integration. I was at a conference on EU-Asia relations last Friday, and one observer used very strong words that Australia and New Zealand play quite an obstructive role, and they're basically not seen as good players sometimes in Asian integration and regionalism. Could you expand this and could you comment on
before you answer that, we have our other two participants who are skulking into the back of the room and think they're going to be, but they're actually going to be required to come up here. And sorry to interrupt, but I just wanted to, Yoshi, come on up here, and Michael, Yoshi can be a right winger and Michael a left winger. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
That's
good.
It's middle of the road.
Yoshi, of course, is from Keio University. He's an old friend with long ANU connections. But Michael also. Is this your first trip to Australia?
It is.
Yeah, welcome.
Thank you.
We're in sort of the middle here of discussing Australian identity, I suppose, amongst other things. Would anyone like to respond to the question in terms of? You might want to just restate it just very quickly.
Sure. Basically, at the one conference last week, there was a person who observed that Australia and New Zealand present obstacles to regional integration and regionalism. And those words to me, as an Australian, they were very strong words, and Australians often have a very positive view themselves, I guess, in terms of regional integration and cooperation.
Who's complaining? Who's saying?
Basically, a participant, an Asian participant from the South Asian experts. South Asian.
Okay. Any takers?
Just very quickly, I think maybe he's responding to Kevin excluding them from the quadrilateral, not anything else. But I think from Southeast Asia, I don't think that is the mainstream view. In particular, we talk about Malaysia, Indonesia, Singapore, Brunei, Thailand. I don't share that view. I think one swallow doesn't mean the three. No? I think increasingly there are issues. But I think on the whole, Australia is seen as a very constructive player. So I find it very difficult to swallow that as the mainstream view. There will be issues with regard to maybe differences in terms of culture and so on and so forth. But primarily as a security player, I think from the FPTA to the bilateralism, I mean, that's where the beef is, and the evidence will speak otherwise. So it's South Asian talking about it. Maybe they're complaining you guys not playing enough role in that part of the world, but Southeast Asia, that's where Australia has been so proactive, not just under the Labour, you can go back the last 60 years. So I think the facts will speak otherwise. So I don't share that.
I second that. APEC wouldn't be here without Australia. Now, when APEC was proposed, we all know that there was a very strong opposition from Malaysia. You're not Asian, you're out, and we Asian would like to have this institution, blah, blah, blah. Maybe that reaction is successor to this kind of reaction, but as a matter of fact, Australia has played a critical role in multilateral institutions because you are interested, you have a strong interest in multilateral institutions. And having said that, we can also use Australia for divisive purposes. Tokyo may have done that, but then I think our present cabinet is pulling back from that position. We should never use multilateral groupings for geopolitical purposes to enhance crisis, and we're not doing that right now.
I was speaking to Henning and Oli this morning, I think during a break, DFAT, about sorry for the academic analogy, but Orrin Young's model of entrepreneurial diplomacy. And I suppose, if we're looking at Australia from a favorable context, we could very well, I suppose, nominate ourselves as an entrepreneurial leadership actor in terms of institution building or whatever. But I thought perhaps Sandy Rowley, if you had any observations on that, and then I see Graham having his head up. Is that theoretically, does a theory match the reality here in your view, realizing this is your first trip to Australia?
Australia explore all of that, but I think you're absolutely right in pointing out that we often, again from the theoretical perspective, assume that there's a kind of direct correlation between either power and the role you play, or how much you are kind of caught up in having interest at stake and so on. But that can be very, talking from a European experience, we have had many cases where a country have a specific location that means you can play a role, and you can play a role out of proportion for what you would expect from that country. I mean, during the Cold War, of course, there are all these famous examples of in Finland or OSCE process and all kind of countries where you say, why would this country suddenly be here? The setup can point at very different positions to who has a chance of playing a particular role in the diplomatic process. So in that sense, I think it makes a lot of sense to not rule out a country from any kind of grand picture, but look very specifically at the political situation and then see the chances. But maybe I was actually thinking that you would have looked at me earlier when you asked about the reactions to the elections and expected an American and a European perspective. And I'm not going to necessarily just throw it in now if you want to continue this, but
We could certainly come back to it, but I have one other quick inquiry, and that is that because the ASEAN, as I think Keechee and others have pointed out, the ASEAN actors perceive themselves in the pivot in terms of the institution building, and yet Australia perceives itself to be an entrepreneurial type. So where does the twain meet here? Or is there a natural tension, policy tension generated between the two in a way that's going to make it tougher to actually move towards coherent institution building? And I thought...
The point could be that sometimes you have a chance, that sometimes you play a strong role because you have to, because you are in an unfortunate position where you have to act to get out of a problem or so on. Sometimes you play a role because you have the power to it, but actually sometimes you can play a role exactly because there are less suspicion against you, because you, think of Norway's role in the various international negotiations and so on. Why Norway? It doesn't make sense at all, but exactly therefore, sometimes it's an opportunity to be the country that doesn't have a designated role, because then there's less suspicion. So I mean, this play of who can do what, at least these three dimensions of it, that if you have too much vested interest, that's sometimes an opportunity, but sometimes a disadvantage. Power is sometimes an advantage, but sometimes a disadvantage, because there will also be more suspicion against those who build institutions and thereby place themselves at the center of it. And there's a limit, after all, to how powerful Australia will ever become, which is an advantage.
I think the statement about Australia posing some obstacles for regional integration, I don't know how the true intention of that statement, but in some sense, I don't see any obstacles that Australia present in terms of behavioral terms. I think many of the Australian proposals and others are really constructive. I think what mattered most to at least some Southeast Asian and some East Asians is the more sort of ideational or theological view. What constitutes East Asia? It's a sort of a theological debate. Whether Australia naturally belong to what is called East Asia or not. And then some, previously, at least, Dr. Mahathir said that East Asia doesn't include Australia and New Zealand. While some in Japan and others and Singaporeans, concept of East Asia is being evolved, and therefore it is unnatural to exclude somebody who can become part of what we conceive of an East Asia in the future. This is a sort of ideational or sort of a debate about the creation of the concept, concept of a region. And in that sense, that's a difficult battle. And I think Australians have to face with this sort of battle in this concept. It's not much to do, I think. At least it's not directly related to the behavioral or action level debate. Action level, I think Australia has always been playing very constructive role in my understanding.
Graham first, and then the gentleman in the back, and then the gentleman sitting to his right, and then four. So I've got four. Okay, Graham first.
Graham DeBello, write for Radio Australia and for the ABC on foreign affairs. Now, being from the press gallery, what I should be asking Professor Tanaka and Professor Fujiwara about, of course, is the Kevin Rudd as the Mandarin candidate and how worried that Japan is that the Prime Minister hasn't run Tokyo. But I actually want to ask you about the trilateral dialogue, and perhaps even Michael Oslin would be interested in this. It seems, I think, that the trilateral dialogue is a creation of a particular period in some ways, very expansive Japanese government at the time, Richard Armitage approach to life and architecture, John Howard signing up eventually to the security framework with Japan. So my question to you is whether the trilateral dialogue has real institutional strength, whether Japan actually sees institutional interests that can be pursued through the trilateral process, or whether in fact it might be seen as being the product of a series of administrations that might not actually get much legs as we go into a new period. And I'd be interested, even if you want to think about that also in terms of the Quad approach, which hasn't had much attention in the sense that both the previous Howard government and the newer government both ruled out their approach to the Quad. Well, that's perhaps getting too far off the thing. I'm really interested in how you see the trilateral.
So who would like to start? Aichi, you didn't say anything yet. You're a sort of a specialist in US-Japan, so maybe we'll start with you and then we can sort of go around.
Okay, I'm going to give a presentation tomorrow. If I say too much, I would lose.
Just say tomorrow.
About trilateral business, I think it will continue. The trilateral cooperation between Japan and USA and Australia will continue to progress. However, I don't think there's much progress in the case of another trilateral arrangement among Japan, USA, and India for many reasons. But at the same time, I want to say that bilateral defense cooperation between Japan and India may probably progress in the near future. That's another important development that has been taking place in the last few several years.
Okay. Other takers on this?
Very briefly, I've been agreeing to everybody this morning, but I agree with you. The trilateral strategic dialogue will continue because it's based on the achievement of bilateral alliances. And there are very well-developed security arrangement between U.S., Japan, and Japan, U.S., Australia, and then we have a development of arrangement between Japan and Australia. I don't think this trend can be reversed. India is a different matter. How we go from here? I would argue that ROK, Republic of Korea, will be brought back into this dialogue. Because of the previous administration, Korea had various troubles with Washington. I don't know whose fault is that, but anyway, with the new administration in power, the Korean government would enhance security dialogue with the United States, and then this would almost naturally be extended to Australia, Japan, and the United States. The question is whether this would be against multilateral institutions in other areas. Mr. Howard, and for that matter, Mr. Koizumi or Mr. Abe, were not really interested in multilateral institutions aside from strategic alliances. This can change in the future because of new administration in Australia and Japan, and very possibly the United States.
Professor Soy, actually sitting on my right, was an integral participant in the Australia-Japan Track 2 Security Dialogue, which was just completed not too long ago. And I know you have some views on this, so maybe you might want to come in at this juncture.
Thank you. I'm sure I have some views, but I don't know if my brain can function. just having traveled from Newcastle, England, to Canberra, taking 36 hours. I'll try. to begin with, I think talking about what some analysts like to call minilateralism has become somewhat a fashion these years. And by minilateralism, basically they mean trilateralism. And here we are talking of US, Japan, Australia, but we also have US, Japan, South Korea, and there is new kind of development among Japan, South Korea, China, and the first summit meeting among those three countries is likely to happen in Japan toward the end of this year. And what else? There should be a few more trilateral frameworks. And my view is that each of these trilateral frameworks have a kind of unique function to play in the bigger picture of regional cooperation. And Japan, China, South Korea, they're going to talk about East Asian regionalism, perhaps broadly speaking, and particularly in the domain of economic and other functional cooperation. And Japan, US, South Korea has its own, agenda. And I think similarly, Japan, Australia, US, this trilateral has its own agenda. And maybe primarily talking about maybe the China issue, if not necessarily as an antagonistic style, but talking about the future of China, how our alliances can deal with it. And perhaps we can also talk about the function of the U.S. role in the region in this trilateral framework, and perhaps managing the relationship between two alliances, and so I think it has specific agenda which are important within the kind of broad spectrum of regional cooperation agenda. So I think it should be promoted, but the important thing is perhaps this shouldn't be too ambitious. I mean, we have to be very clear about the merits of this particular trilateralism. And if we approach this from that sort of, general perspective, having in mind functions of other trilateral frameworks, then this will contribute tremendously to what we all aspire for. I mean, regional peace and stability.
There's one more comment from Michael, and then we'll get to the next question. Yeah,
I'll just jump in quickly on the American side, and to your question on whether this is the creation of a particular period or particular personalities, and I think it's both, and that isn't necessarily contradictory in terms. When you think about when the first push for it's coming around 2001 by Alexander Downer. You think of the period, it's less than 10 years since the end of the Cold War, so I think it is due to the recognition that one type of international era and set of arrangements had passed, and there was a groping to try and find something new, which we're close to it now, but as you get farther away, it'll probably seem that it happened fairly quickly, that somebody started talking about, well, if you have three nations with roughly, congruent goals and ideas, and certainly strong relations, should they not try to come together a little bit more formally. The other side of it, I think the mirror side, is of course the hub and spoke structure of U.S. alliances in the region was already 60 years old. I mean, it's an extraordinarily long period of time to have that type of alliance system in existence, and it's rather abnormal for international relations. So again, I don't think it's surprising that there would be, you know, an attempt to see if there were new ways of doing things. On the other hand, I would just, you know, return to the actual phrasing of what this is, which is simply a dialogue. You know, no one, and certainly not in the United States government, I think sees it as going anything beyond that at this point. It's not designed to replace the alliance structure. It's not designed to radically rejigger the idea of hub and spoke. And so there's not a lot of pay. You know, you don't have to pay into it a lot to get a dialogue going and continue to discuss various issues. And even when it was new, there were members of the U.S. government, high members of the State Department, that already had shown that they weren't interested in it, and therefore it got shunted down to working level. So I think that we shouldn't necessarily look at it as something fully formed and coming out to radically replace what is in existence. And I don't think it's going to go much farther, at least in the foreseeable future, than where it is now, which seems to be the comfort level.
You know, Bob Gates gave a speech in Indonesia, I think about 3 or 4 weeks ago, right after he came here, and said, you know, we got to do something with hub and spokes. You know, it really. And then McCain, in his foreign policy address about 4 or 5 days ago, was saying, we got to rely more on our allies mm-hmm. than in the past. So I'm wondering if maybe there's a bit of a crystallization going on here in terms of, well, we got to do something, but we're just now getting around to beginning. I mean, you guys are from Washington, so is that unfair, or are we beginning to see by osmosis, perhaps, a reconstitution of conceptualizing the hub and spokes more towards the regional, the emergence of these regional architectures, whatever you want to call them?
I think it's at the very front end of that process, mm-hmm. so it's really hard to know. I mean, just precisely the point that Misha made, that the hub and spokes has worked so well. What exactly is the rationale for introducing something new? Mm-hmm. And that is contrasted with the sense that, well, the region is really different, mm-hmm. and the relationships are different, and there are new opportunities. And so, but it's very early on, I think. What do you think?
Absolutely. Yeah, I agree. So keep tuned, essentially. Yeah. I think this gentleman back here has been quite patient, so please go ahead, and then to the gentleman to your right after.
My name's Adrian Porter. I'm a law and politics honors student at Monash University, and I work for the chair of the Foreign Affairs Subcommittee of the Joint Standing Committee on Foreign Affairs, Defense and Trade. Although my question is very much my own, I must say. The first part of the question is in relation to India. Now, I appreciate that Asia Pacific often does not connote South Asia in some people's minds, although I suspect in the most conventional terms it does. The earlier discussion in respect of maritime security, you would see that India has the same SLOC concerns, I would imagine, as Japan and China would in the Straits of Malacca. And yet you see no Indian involvement. It often puzzles me that India is excluded or not invited into regional partnerships to a large extent outside, say, now somewhat outmoded or certainly in an Australian sense, rejected concept of containment. And I do find, given that this is what my whole thesis is on, Australia's relationships with India and China, it's quite odd that that we don't seek greater involvement on the part of the Indian government. I don't know whether it's legacy issues inherited from the FCO and DFAT with an antipathy towards India or a suspicion of India in its early socialist phase or as a former client state of the Soviet Union, but it seems quite unhelpful that we don't engage India while understandably having an engagement with China, we put perhaps somewhat greater emphasis than I think we should, given that we don't put much emphasis on India. The other aspect of my question is sort of implications for Australia, part of the title behind you. In Australia, I've noticed that there's very little debate on our relationships with both India and China, and it seems to me to be somewhat of a zero-sum game. The former government, again, this is just my political view as a Labor staffer, seemed to have an enormous emphasis on its relationship with China, discovered India in its final year.
I'm wondering also why it is that there's very little discussion in the media as to, you know, double-digit growth in China's defence spending with little explanation. You know, you only ever see examination of that in fairly conservative or neoconservative American foreign policy journals. You do it here, like I did it in an honours seminar at Monash last year. You know, you can get into raving arguments and be told you're a neoconservative when you're a social democrat. So, where's it?
Well, remind us when we convene our next week at our seminar. We'll just take your question as sort of the entire gamut. It's a very broadly, but thank you. Some very good points. Shell, maybe you might want
to. Well, I can try to kick it off. I'm very happy you raised the India elephant, so to speak, in this conversation. I think you're absolutely right. In fact, if you go back to, I think it was 2002, for several months, the United States Navy and the Indian Navy shared the patrolling of the Strait of Malacca to provide security until the littoral states, particularly Malaysia and Indonesia, objected. And this ultimately led to the creation of Malcindo and the joint patrols and so on. I think one of the great concerns with on the part of the rest of the Asian region is that any bringing of India into the security discussion brings in China immediately, because the two are seen as essentially, in naval terms at least, arming against each other. And there's actually no doubt that both China and India are developing significant naval capacities. India is in the process of acquiring a second aircraft carrier. China is developing, already has a good green water navy, and in due course may well have a blue water navy. There's a lot of fear that these two naval powers may confront each other in some fashion. On the other hand, you could argue that their interests are completely compatible. That is, maintaining the freedom of the slots. So that you could, if you were somewhat imaginative, it seems to me, you could think of ways in which these two countries could collaborate as they build a naval power.
Can I? I get very agitated when you talk about the navies, you know, just because they exist and there is a possibility of tariffs. The question I think we have all been discussing is architecture. Architecture, sort of planetarism and so on. My question is that, what is a security threat? On the one hand, the negative part, and what is the positive part of this architecture seeks to achieve? You know, and why is it that we are talking, you know, sort of almost sub debate level, that there is something out there which we should all be very worried about? You know, it's just like the Korean, North Korean weapon. Now, how much of it was a real threat, or the Iranian nuclear weapon? You know, and how much energy has been spent to deal with it? You know, how much money has been spent to arm various countries for such a possibility?
Sure.
You know, and the alternative question I want to ask, okay, if there's no real threat, then what is all this money doing? What are the opportunity costs of this money? And perhaps we should actually consider what are the quote-unquote threats in the immediate future or near short-term future that is realistic. Rather than to say, well, look, you know, because the Indian Army, the Indian Navy is there, the Chinese Navy is there, they're bound to be, okay, I don't buy that, sorry.
I think you make a very, very good argument. And if I could do what Bill did just a while ago, and that is use a little bit of IR theory, if you're a constructivist, essentially you're making the constructivist argument. That this really has to do with incompatible ideas, incompatible concepts of what the security relationship between these two countries are. Because if, in fact, they're both concerned with simply maintaining a free flow of international commerce, then there is no conflict. Mm. But if one side views the other as having the capability at some point to disrupt the free flow of international commerce, then you do have the problem.
Yeah, but the question is, why would and which party would want to disrupt or to create that situation? I mean, what is the catalyst? I mean,
the ideologies of decision makers.
Or the ideological position of decision makers.
Well, same thing.
Yeah. Or mistakes.
or mistakes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But people can make mistakes.
We respect this is why I raise the point about they are discussing this thing.
Sorry, could you say it a little more loudly? And then this poor gentleman sitting to your right obviously sees a convergence of about three or four of his concerns here, so we'll let him get in next. But would you like to come in now? Yeah, okay, go ahead. And then we'll come back, because I think we've got some interesting... Yeah, go ahead.
I'm Kali Saniyao. I work in the Parliament Library in the economics section. I do economic analysis. My question to Professor Fujiwara about issues that are very dear to us about Taiwan, and which is the main threat in the Asian Pacific security architecture. So with the change in government in Taiwan, what would be the relative position of Beijing in your security threat perception in Japan? Whether Beijing will be a bit flexible, a bit normal, or they are still agitated in terms of bringing issues to the architecture? What Japan sees and what Japan sees about Australia's contribution to this relative new alignment in the Pacific area with Taiwanese government and Australian government.
And we should probably, after you answer, perhaps have Zhu Feng come into play on this and role as well, being the China analyst that they are. But we'll start with Keijing now.
It's a question I don't want to answer. but maybe I should. There are people who are alarmed about the outcomes of the election in Taiwan. The new leader, with his known close ties to Beijing, and less experience in relationship to Japan, instantly ignites some fear among some people. And having said that, I don't think our government is reacting strongly toward the situation, because Taiwan, it might be a rude way to put it, needs Japan in many ways. And our ties with Taiwan is pretty stable. Their options in changing our relationship is limited. And also, it is against their interest to ally with China and work against Japan. The more imminent question would be how we can put Taiwan in international negotiation, international bodies, and this is a tall order. As you must know very well, Taiwan is a member of APEC but not ARF, and Beijing was strongly against Taiwan's membership in ARF. How long we can sustain this situation is an open question, but I do not think Tokyo would be an advocate of including Taiwan in international bodies in the very near future. So essentially it's a status quo situation, and I don't think the government is alarmed as some of the critics in the press.
Shubham, maybe you'd like to...
Okay, I think the message from Taiwan after Mao in the election is complicated to mailing. Mm-hmm. I think on one hand, so Mao's winning up is a great fortune, not only for two Chinese, across the Strait, but also for regional security. So Mao's win also will is the ease in a very escalating crisis of the military conflict in the Taiwan Strait. But on the other hand, Lama also make very clear, he would like to visit the Japan, States as well, and also will make such a Japan some kind of highlighted policy, preference. And it's also upset the mainlanders. So far we're also just the way what kind of a response should just be properly issued. But anyway, I think the Beijing now just been pushed into a very, it seems to me, a more constructive track. We are ready to talk with Ma, we are ready to compromise. We are ready to just raise the issue into a new level, a level where it will be more secure and cooperative.
Well, would you have any input on this?
Yeah, that's a very fascinating question. Ma will bring movement to Taiwan's diplomacy. He's tried to do two things, I think, really. One is to facilitate a better relationship with the mainland, a more realistic and more reasonable relationship with the mainland. And I think it's true that the Fujian Tao and Wanzhaobao government is more accessible than perhaps the Jiang Zemin government was to talk across the strait. And so there may be a revival of cross-strait negotiations in some form. He's already raised that possibility. But the other thing that has always been a Taiwanese concern is Taiwan's isolation. Because, of course, the mainland has insisted upon no other country can have relations with Taiwan, and that Taiwan cannot join in any multilateral organizations for which statehood is required. And this has been part of the mainland's strategy to facilitate the reunification with eventual reunification with Taiwan, insisting that Taiwan is already part of the mainland, so that Taiwan would be isolated and be more amenable to reunification negotiations. But certainly, from Ma's perspective, he will insist that not only that they improve relations with the mainland, but that the mainland allows, as part of this sort of bargaining, as a bargaining chip, that the mainland allows Taiwan some diplomatic leeway. That means that they have greater access to international fora. And I don't know how far I will push that, but that's always been a bone of contention from the very beginning of the Singapore talks way back in 1991. The mainland would have good relations with Taiwan across the table, but Taiwan would always insist that this always extended to Taiwan's relations with other countries, and that will be a big bargaining point. Yeah.
Yes.
Just a few words. I think the
you've got to speak up a little bit, I think, just to the back.
Okay, just a short remark that I think the situation in Taiwan has become more calculable than before. Not because that Ma Ying-jeou won the election, but because that the concerned states have tacitly agreed upon the concept of what they call the dual restraint policy. On the part of China, the restraint could be imposed upon non-use of the military force against Taiwan. And on the side of Taiwan, most of the concerned states have agreed to not to inflate the independence of domestic affairs. And that kind of, and especially since 2003, that when the Bush administration negatively responds to the 2004 presidential election over the referendum issue, that has, the trend has been strengthened much. And also the domestic politics within Taiwan, that independence movement has been widely offset by the more economic interdependence between the mainland and also the Taiwan. Even for the former independence faction in the southern and the medium areas who had a doing a lot of small and medium enterprises, has been quite a large trend has been there to increase the interdependence over towards the mainland. China has been there, so that reflects a lot in the election, which that the promoted Kuomintang supporter has been increasing even in the southern areas of Taiwan. So these kind of issues are involved. I think that the situation in Taiwan has become more calculable than ever before.
Great. I think we'll go to the next question. I see your hand, but I think I may have missed someone after you. Perhaps not, in which case that would be you. And let me just indicate there are one or two folks on the panel yet that have yet to have an opportunity to express their views, but with their willingness, of course, I know who they are, and I'm going to particularly focus on the opportunity of perhaps getting them into the act as well. So, but please ask your question, and we'll go from there.
I'm Lynette Mollard, and I work in the Parliamentary Relations Office here in Parliament House, and have some involvement in providing assistance to the Pacific. And it's really following on from the question before. under the Asia-Pacific Regional Cooperation Architecture, I'd like to bring more of the focus in on the Pacific. We've seen China-Taiwan, what they call checkbook diplomacy, and then with the new Taiwanese government saying that they're moving away from that. My question is really to any of the panel, but I guess particularly to the people from Asia, is where are things heading in the Pacific, in this Asia-Pacific relationship?
Great. Any takers? Maybe, Zhufeng, you're obviously your country's been mentioned here as one of the key actors in the Pacific scenario. Maybe you could start off with maybe China's latest reading on the South Pacific relative to the Taiwan situation there, and then we'll move on to others. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I think the just policy is frequently finds a lot of controversy. So now I also feel very shocked by the international response to the Tibet issue. I think the Taiwan is almost the same. So for most of Chinese, they feel it's unfair for international society to just keep criticism against Beijing for its policy of Tibet. So Taiwan policy is almost the same. So that's why I think that one of the new points we also have to just highlight in the consideration of China's response or China's thinking about such a security point is always about how such a interactions could be running reciprocally, we say, benefiting both sides. Or also it could just boosting the understanding of both sides. So that's why I think the Taiwan issue now is a very big example. So now Beijing just pull closer to the rest of the members. I don't think how say the China sovereign claim always at the top. The Taiwan's democracy also should be just always equally and fairly respected. So then that's why I see a growing flexibility with Beijing's basic stance over the Taiwan. But on contrary, so when the Taiwan is just getting a little bit, let's say, released, then the Tibet issue is also is followed. So then it's also just warned us of some of the new reality, for example. So what's the regional, let's say, complexity and the regional diversity of security in East Asia? China is some kind of very, very cruel reality. It's hard to just change the overnight. So that's why when we discussed some of, for example, the security issues, I think from our points, some kind of strong strengthening of, let's say, democratic alliance will be very scary to China. And also will push the China in a very negative way. So the Tibet issue also will be another case. If regional members always just think China should be to blame at large, then there is no space for Beijing to defend our policy. China's response also will be very negative. Actually, such international pressure is seen to me tragically hiding the Beijing's hard lines rather than just raise the flexibility. So, how we say in terms of perceptions, in terms of some of the efficiency of promoting the security cooperation, then I think one of the important task force in front of us is how to reinforce the understanding. Thanks.
Show very quickly, and then Henning and Philip haven't had an opportunity to project, and I'm going to invite them to project about anything they'd like during, but Shogo is just very quick on this one.
I'll focus on a question about the Pacific. First point about whether the checks were difficult to he said the both governments are saying that they'll end it. I myself am not quite sure about this. My NGO might
be... the Taiwanese said
that. The Taiwanese said that, yes. But actually, China matches it as well, you see. So you get as a result, you get Pacific Island or other nations really playing Taiwan against one off against each other. And
I'm not quite sure, although despite Manager saying that he's going to end it, Taiwan is desperate for diplomatic space, and it gets quite frantic, and really, I think it remains to be seen whether they are going to end it. But I guess the flip side of this is China will try and match this, and one of the implications for the Pacific will be the popping up of very corrupt governments, which will continue to play Beijing against Taiwan and try to maintain their power as well, and using that aid for their own purposes. So this is something that they have to, that the international community might have to keep an eye on. And particularly so because China has become a huge presence in the Pacific, some people argue by default. Not because they projected their power, but mainly because of lack of interest or lack of political will on the part of the US, and also on Australia, on the part of Australia as well. And this is probably the region where Australia can make a big difference. It has a lot of economic cooperation schemes. Also, it sent peacekeepers to East Timor and still has the police force, if I remember correctly. And so this is where probably if Australia is worried about instability in the Pacific, this is where it has to play a leading role. I think it's its backyard. And China has become the leader there because of the lack of interest. I'm not quite sure what the administration's view on this is, but it'd be interesting to see how Australia regains the momentum in the Pacific.
Yeah, Rudd seems to be highly sensitive to this because he's accentuating his focus on the so-called arc of instability. But we have to be careful about what the arc of instability is, because I think the vision of the arc of instability would be Melanesia, and then maybe west towards PNG, and then of course very touchy Papua, and then going from there. But that's different from the weak and vulnerable states in most of the South Pacific area, which is a different type of problem, where the rule of law. I'm not looking at Henning too closely. The rule of law, it seems to me, would be a marvelous alternative approach to get the weak and vulnerable into some type of systemic predictability relative to the sort of zero-sum anarchy of great power politics by default. And I just didn't know whether maybe that might stimulate you to say.
Thank you. I have to remind you of the fact that I'm not a political scientist. I'm trying to play the role as an enlightened lawyer in this audience here. Now, Australia and Denmark, we have a lot in common. I'm not thinking about Crown Prince Mary here. when we are talking about Japan, China, and India, both of us are relatively small, I should say. I mean, of course, Australia is bigger than Denmark, middle-ranging maybe, but for small-ranging countries, and I guess middle-ranging countries, it is very important to participate in multilateralism, in multilateral organization, because you cannot play a role all by yourself in bilateral deliberations. So the point is, of course, I know very little about Australian politics, but you will, of course, have your own agenda, as Denmark has its own agenda. As we actually have proven, I mean, our Prime Minister was abstaining directly from, he almost acted as a traitor, representing the press here, with regard to the role of the war in Iraq. He abstained from the Franco-German position on Iraq, and he used, if I may say so, Blair as a stepping stone. Sorry, in order to make alliances over the dam to the U.S. So, which served two purposes. The first was to prove that he was not that strong a European. He reminded us of the fact that he was more interested in liberal democracy. The heavy version, the true version in his eyes, namely the U.S. liberal democracy, and secondly, it was payback in a positive sense for thanking the Americans and the Brits, of course, for what they did to us during the Second World War when Denmark collaborated with Germany. Maybe you've seen the picture where. No comparison to Kevin Rudd yesterday or the day before yesterday, but But our prime minister was actually also in Washington, and they were even touching each other, Bush, and there was a lovely picture with Bo Rasmussen and Bush standing in the back, touching each other. So they are really buddies, I would say. We're staying in Iraq, as far as I understand. At least we're not withdrawing the same way that I understood that the Australians are doing. So we can be, even as a small country, we can be making troubles in Europe, still being accepted as a member. We are trying to stop the process because our population is, some of it, a lot of them, our people is actually against the European Union. So we are making troubles, but still we are respected and part of the process. And I think, and I hope, that could be the rule for Australia as well.
You're being far too modest about Denmark. Mm-hmm. Denmark was one of the great practitioners of the diplomacy of subtlety during the Cold War, with the Thule Air Base on one hand, and you, unlike the New Zealanders, actually finessed a partial compromise on the part of the Americans towards the NCND. You know, if the New Zealanders really wanted to influence, they should have studied Danish diplomacy before long they actually went. Yeah, that's my view, at least. So. Philip, two items left on the agenda, I think, because we're coming short of time. I want to give Philip a chance to join the discussion. He gave just a marvelous presentation about, 2 weeks ago now, I think, in our departmental seminar on, you know, sort of how leaders think and perceive about war, and I just like it. And the other thing is, we need to come back to your tough question about threat before we leave. But Philip first,
First of all, let me say how it would have been nice if more people had used Blair as some sort of stone. I don't know about the stone. Unfortunately, that wasn't the case for a while. And you and we are in lockstep over many of these problems. And the question was raised, what would the Europeans expect from the new Australian government? I mean, I expect from the British point of view, it all revolves around the one word really, Afghanistan, because if we're reducing our presence in Iraq, we're getting a bigger presence in Afghanistan. Most of us, and I guess many Australians as well, would think that the mess in Afghanistan is as big as the mess in Iraq. And I noticed, I think it was your Chief of Defence Staff saying over the weekend, oh, we might be in Afghanistan for the next 40 years. Mm-hmm. Well, that's of course colonialism under another name. And I'm not sure how well that's going to wash amongst public opinion, nor do I really think it's in any way viable, quite frankly. And what we're going to be debating with you, I suspect, or what our new government, Brown government, is going to be debating, is what we're going to do about Afghanistan and how somehow we're going to get ourselves out of that mess as we've tried to get ourselves out of Iraq.
Interesting.
But you brought up a question, my paper earlier this week, or last week, what I am working on, of course, is constitutional change in Britain, because there's a big push following on Iraq and Afghanistan in Britain to give Parliament more of a role in restraining the executive. Why did we get it wrong? And one of the reasons some people allege, though not me, is that the constitution was wrong and not enough power was given to Parliament, too much to the executive. So over lunch, when we go there, if any of you have any ideas about that, I would be very grateful for them. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And Henning, you have just a
I just want to make an excuse, because although I'm 1 hour closer to Australia than Professor Sawyer, coming from Copenhagen, I was jet lagged when I said, see that one. Ulrich was shaking his head. Of course, we're out of Iraq, but the
ideological is out of Afghanistan,
exactly. So, my point was, we are still buddies and allies in Afghanistan. And the argument was precisely that we left Iraq because we wanted to concentrate in Afghanistan. I'm so sorry. Yeah. Don't quote me for that.
And coming back to your very tough question, which I don't think we've probably got too close to answering, although I think Kiko was close in the sense that he was talking about essentially the 1914 syndrome revisited, which is the perception, misperception, wherever Bob Jervis is, God bless him. And that
when you have material power in the form of large concentrations of military capability, you've got the sea lanes of communication, you've got energy security, which is becoming more tumultuous over time, and you've got economies like India and Japan that are clearly going to, you know, have to fuel themselves, not totally through nuclear or green technologies. You know, that's the stuff of volatility. And I think what Shell was getting at, and I'm only to be fair to both of you guys, I'm going to let you respond to this. I think what Shell was getting at to a certain extent is that in that type of environmental uncertainty, the hedging syndrome is really alive and well in terms of squaring up the material capabilities on one hand with the soft power diplomatic type approaches to minimize the probability that those material capabilities are going to be played. And that's where the China transparency problem comes into play, because we have yet to see. So I thought I might just let you guys sort of, and Ken is sort of our geopolitician of the group, so if you wanted to come in on this too, maybe. So maybe we'll let the three of you sort of, go ahead.
First, I think I'd like to point about India and China is that, well, you know, these are the two powers who actually fought wars in the 1960s. And then they both had nuclear weapons and ballistic missiles, you know, capable of attacking the mutual capital. And they had very long borders, which they still have not been able to resolve. And I think sea lines of communications, energy dependence, in a way, were new additional elements in the relations between India and China. And from the viewpoint of something totally impartial, these conflicts could be manageable and they could find mutually agreeable solutions. But the history of these various things could easily stir up what might be regarded as a security dilemma. And so far, I think both leaders in Beijing and leaders in New Delhi have been wise enough to lower these contentious elements and try to work out their mutual relations. And so we can be quite positive about India-China relations. And then, of course, economic interdependence between India and China is really booming up. Their mutual trade in recent years is growing more than 30-40% annually. That's a tremendous increase of trade between India and China. And in fact, I think India's relations with ASEAN was also increasing tremendously. Trade between India and ASEAN is also moving up at the rapid as rapidly as India-China trade, 30-40% annually. And so, in other words, there are certain elements of classical, you know, power politics, but you can see lots of elements of economic integration and economic interdependence. And so I think we need to create a lot more institutionalizations and having opportunities for both India and China engaged in various, you know, multilateral setting. And in that, for that matter, I think, so we cannot afford to ignore India and China in any kind of multilateral discussion in the region.
That's great. Shall?
Actually, the two of you have said it all. I have nothing to add, really, other than to just point out that not only are all of these other linkages existing, but even in the area of military affairs, the two countries' armed forces are exercising with each other. And that, too, is, I think, a sign of the point that you made earlier, Bill, that diplomacy can help smooth the rough edges of the relationship. So I think the two of you put it very well.
Thought this is sort of right up your alley, Ken. So I thought I'd just.
So there's nothing to add from previous speakers, but just to relate your earlier questions about the concepts of the security, why you need to dwell upon such a issue as a priority, prioritized issue. I think the There are so many categories to analyze. There have been like high intensity possible conflict to lower intensity conflict. And there are specific characters in Northeast Asia, Southeast Asia, South Asia, and also the Pacific region. But it's quite important that in the recent phenomena is the rise of asymmetrical threat. There are so many non-state actors are causing a greater threat than ever before. And when it comes to relate with the highly intensified the kind of weapons, like weapons of mass destruction and so on, that kind of magnitude might become larger as well. And these kind of emergence of the asymmetrical threat has also, I would say, upgraded and reloaded the traditional threat we have, such as in Korean Peninsula. And also several, I think, the non-traditional activities in Southeast Asia as well, if that is related to the asymmetrical factor. And so that's why we're concerned about the development of North Korean nuclear issue, if there is a proliferation issues are attached to it. And we're concerned about Jamaa Islamiya and other kind of activities, because it may be attached to the global terrorist networks as well. So that those kind of formerly regionally marginalized threats are now linked with a more wider region and also the global affairs as well. And that may, I think, become a kind of possible shift from the kind of hub and spoke step to more like a network's security, because of those threats are things without a vision as well. So that's my reasons about why those threats are highlighted and why we are transferring those mechanisms into a more network step.
Well, I suppose the problem is that there's a danger of mistaking the power for the whole. No, and I think this is a critical problem. The other, in response to what you said, Professor, about India and China, is that, see, India has actually been much more internally and encapsulated for a long time. It's only in the last 30, 40 years that it started to expand. And we have not yet to see how India's attempt to acquire, said resources like China has done in Africa and so on, and whether in those areas they will the rivalry or conflict, you know. And I think this, I agree with you that they are imponderable, but what I'm just saying is that my original point was that there is no inevitability that no, there should be violence or there should be conflict. The question is, how do you recognize there are legitimate needs, whether it be security needs in the case of Iranians, you know, on the North Korean, and the legitimate interest of the region in trying to accommodate. We heard earlier that, you know, there are some countries which are quite happy to live with a nuclearized North Korea. You know? And I'm sure that if you are Iranian looking out, you say, excuse me, you know, who's going to look after us? If everybody's, you know, saying that we should not have a nuclear weapon. So the same question arises. You know? So how this whole process developed and changed is a critical issue for us. But what I'm saying is that we should not, like some people said, well, there was a Cold War, we're still looking for a new enemy, and we have to focus on this new enemy and make it a bigger enemy so that we can keep our institutions going, and our industry going, and our defense industry going. So one of the questions which I asked, for example, is that the nature of threat, which I raised, you know, do we need all the sophisticated, you know, multi-billion dollar planes to fight Islamic terrorism? I don't know. It seems to me that the defense seems to be fighting the last war, and yet the changing nature of the conflict is not actually being addressed, because, you know, the strategic vision is encapsulated in the past.
Very eruditely done. Next year's conference topic, you just thank you. We've got a bus problem here in a few minutes, and I want to give these guys an opportunity to eat a sandwich or two. So, Mike, did you have a bus? No. You're okay? Thanks for your compassion. And it's only left for me to say thank you to you for allowing our guests to come here, and also if you could join with me in thanking our guests for what I think they've done. Just to and adjourn so that they can get some sustenance before going to the bus. Thanks again.
I'm going to